still their submission. A lot of members, you would remember that consciousness last year. Make proposal of 10 months before the beginning of the next financial year. Now, this is the, thank you very much, this is part of that process. And sometimes, at the beginning, this process is normally, the presentation is made to this committee. But I think that it would be useful to invite to in future other committees, because the constitution prescribes that FFC makes recommendations, it means that the minister is also obliged to respond to these recommendations. And surely our next budget will contain some of the recommendations which have been adopted by government, others not adopted. Recommendations are by nature our recommendations. So that was also adopted and not. But FSC, if people could close with those, FSC is, I said earlier, it is like a resource to us. But other than this function, the law also, I mean the constitution, also enjoins parliament to consult with FSC on matters that have financial implications. If we don't do that, then it means that we're breaking the law. That's why in terms of the giving of the revenue, Act of Year and the appropriation we conduct with them. Well, we are obliged by the Constitution to do so. However, I do have a request that I want to make with you, Dr. Stan. Is that, you know, during the season of revenue, what we picked up as a committee was that National Treasury has stopped the grant of the electrification of schools because they say that it has reached its a climax, or it has achieved its goal of electrifying all the schools. To us as members of parliament, what that says is that in the country there's no school now that is without electricity. In fact, it's not only electricity, you'll correct me, honourable member. I think it's electricity and water. Mm-hmm. And we do know that out there, there are schools that are still without electricity and without water. What then would like you to assist with in another meeting, not today's meeting. We will set up a meeting where concretely would like to have concrete evidence from yourself, from National Treasury, from Department of Energy, National Department of Energy, to say, look, we think that we have exhausted this mandate. But from yourselves, from Start South Africa, would like as well, independently, to say, no, what they are saying is correct. We'll put it in our program. We'll have a date in our program to deal with that. For now, we can't conclusively say that all the schools don't have electricity. We don't have evidence in front of us that says that. But we do a lot of constituency work as members. And members were really surprised by this. Maybe in the previous years, the grant was meant to stop at some stage. All the grants, the nature of the grants is that. But at some stage it must stop. But we would like to know what is it that informs the stopping of the grant. So that's with those words. I'd like us to say, maybe let's come back to the business of the day, which is your submission for the next budget process. That's also to say, in the past, and I think that Honorable Mashiko, Honorable Swart, people who have been here, who have been part of the joint budget, will assist us. Normally, the NCOP used to take up the process of hearing. But now, the enactment of the Money Bills Amendment Profit and Related Matters established separate committees, both for NA with appropriation, and they have their own appropriation. Now, it's not, I think that what the committee would have to consider is whether we'll have to do our own hearings as a committee. But if we do that, I think we should be wary of a situation of repeating what the NCOP has done. I did talk to the chairperson of appropriation that side, that look, we need to have a meeting where we organize some division of labor, because the act is not clear in terms of who does what. There are clear situations where these are, in terms of the constitution, would fall under section 75 and others under section 76. But others, section 76 means that there are concurrent functions, which means that we need to decide what is it that they are going to deal with, and we're not going to deal with, so that we don't do one and the same thing together. So I don't know in the past if, I don't think that the joint budget held hearings. If it did, I think my colleagues would, what you call it, remind me. It did have hearings on the FFC recommendations. You used to have them.
But in terms of the Money Bills Act, we now like to have presentations by the agency.
Now, what I'm saying, Honorable Swap, is that we are obliged to have the hearings. The joint budget also used to have hearings, but what the NCOP would do would do the hearings with the department. What I'm not clear that I would like you to assist us with is whether, as we were to call a joint budget, you used to invite, for instance, department to comment on those hearings. And that's what Honorable Mashiko wanted to respond to.
What is it? I don't know how to they presented to us. But whatever they said was a tool to assist us. Whenever we called all those departments, we knew that they spoke about quintals. We knew that they spoke about transport. And then whatever they did, as they're doing here, is what we put through to the department, that there's such and such a problem. How do you address school transport, because it's in two departments? How do you address quintal system, because in one village there are different quintals? They informed us, and we used their information as a tool to assist us during our hearings on overspending and underspending. And they even presented to us when there's a workshop. They once gave us a beautiful presentation at the workshop. Thank you.
Now, thank you. Dr. Thank you, Chair, and good morning. I think the Chair started to beg me by indicating why we are appearing here. The financial and fiscal position constituted in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution and the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Okay, thank you very much, Rahim. This admission, oh my God.
Maybe all your cell phones are on, that's why.
No, thank you. This admission is made in compliance with Chapter 13 of the Constitution, the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act as amended, and the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act and related legislation. The recommendations are submitted 10 months prior to tabling of the next Division of Revenue Bill and the budget. Chair, our submission is constructed as follows. It has four chapters to it, and the first chapter will address the global economic crisis, the fiscal framework, and coping with vulnerabilities. Because we know that when there is a crisis, there are always people who are vulnerable in society, and we are addressing that issue. We'll also be talking on options for social assistance reform, how it has coped in the context of the fiscal stress. And then thereafter, we talk on issues of efficiency, because we are saying that not all problems require money, or when they require money, money is actually lying around in some situations, and that money can be collected. So we address the performance of conditional fiscal transfers in the South African fiscal relations system. We talk about local government revenue enhancement programs and fiscal stress. And we talk on the review of the local government equitable share formula. And we also talk on regionalizing municipal services, the case of the EDI. So really what I'm saying here is that the issues of efficiencies will be around conditional fiscal transfers, will be around revenue enhancement, they will be around local government equitable share formula, and then they will also be around regionalizing municipal services. And for that, we'll use the electricity distribution industry as an example. And then the fourth point will be intergovernmental fiscal issues in urban public transport. So in essence then, we have four chapters then, as I have indicated, the crisis, global, social assistance, issues of efficiencies, and then the urban public transport. Now, I think the way we begin, my colleague Ben Bongani will talk on fiscal frameworks and vulnerabilities, and then thereafter he'll introduce the next person who will then talk on the subsequent issues. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Setai. What I'm going to talk about is just to give a picture of what the Work Ethic Commission seems to suggest about the economy, how the economy is going to do going forward. I think when we tabled or when we presented or addressed this committee on the fiscal framework, no, that was the Standing Committee on Finance, but when we tabled our submission on that, we actually did indicate that we have done a bit of modeling at the Commission as a result of the global economic crisis to try and look at what options government has in terms of trying to protect, as Dr. Tatar indicated, to try and protect the vulnerable sections of the South African economy, and also to try and make sure that those that are most vulnerable, which is the elderly and children, are not unduly impacted upon by any decisions that are taken in terms of trying to respond to the global economic crisis. Now, what has happened is that the global economic crisis, basically the impact that has been felt quite heavily in 2008-2009, and the onset was around about 2007. That is when things started to fall apart. So the modeling that the Commission did basically goes back to 2005, uses information that starts from 2005, and looks at what the growth path of the economy was going to be, and therefore what the revenue available for the economy and for government to continue on its programs was going to be if there was no economic crisis, if there was no global economic collapse, what would have happened? And we take two extreme assumptions where the impact is quite severe and where the impact is moderately severe. It's not as severe as it probably is to some of our competitors, our major competitors in the international environment. Now, in terms of the openness and the size of the South African economy, globally, we know that we're a very open economy, so we're very susceptible to movements in wealth demand and changes in investment flows across the board. We respond quite heavily to changes or movements in international prices, especially for commodities, and so on and so forth. Now, there's also, in terms of our exposure to the world economy, tourism, which also seems to play quite a substantial or increasingly substantial or significant role in the South African economy. And there is basically impact on tourism. Finally, we talk about remittances. Remittances don't form a substantial part inward, at least into South Africa. What happens is that probably more remittances go out of South Africa than we get, as opposed to other countries of a similar stature in the world. South Africa is probably net exporter of remittances rather than... So that does not actually cushion the economy at any one point in time, in terms of the assessment. So, in terms of households, what we look at is the consumer and producer prices, and obviously, when we then go to producer prices, we will have to talk about the impacts on employment. And what we saw was that there was a negative impact, and unemployment. Basically increased as a result of the global economic crisis, and obviously that fits into what then becomes available for households. Now, in particular, with particular respect to children, the impact would have to be on consumption, as people lose jobs and all of that. And then there's another dimension to the South African economy, which is quite unique to South Africa in terms of most of the countries that we survey and we try to compare ourselves against, is a very strong social security system that is quite heavily driven by social security grants. Now, your child support grant and your old age pension become very important in a situation like that. So we found that quite a big proportion of people were cushioned by the existence of that social security system. Even though the economy was going down, the impact was also quite heavy on everybody, and probably heaviest on the poorest of the poor children what happened is that the Social Security grant system did try and cushion those children. Now, if one looks at the social assistance program as a package, so we then expand it to include your school nutrition program and your early childhood development, primary health care, and all of that. We look at access numbers, whether they drop or they are likely to drop as we move forward. That is not the case. In fact, when we look at school education at basic levels, your primary to secondary school, the enrollment numbers are quite high. You have very high enrollment numbers. So, and the impact was not very very heavy there. So those programs put together, they seem to have worked very well to cushion the vulnerable sectors of South African by and large. Now, that is not to say that the impact was not negative. If I move to let me move to this. That slide there basically just shows you what under the three scenarios one would be looking at. Now there's one line there at the top one which is quite a straight line. That basically the behavior of the economy, how the economy would behave when you model it. The straight line basically indicates the business as usual scenario where there's no crisis. Now, where the crisis is severe is the green line. I hope that my colors are right. If the green line basically shows the scenario where you have a very severe impact on the South African economy of the global economic crisis. So you see that there's a significant fall in that trend line there between 2009, 2010, you start a process of recovery. But you don't actually get back to the original path where the economy was going. It basically means that you'll have to, if impact was that severe, then you would have to basically adjust the way you do things. And that's really what that says, is that your living standards will basically go down as a result of that, and it will take a very long time to recover. You might not even recover. So it's moving the economy onto a completely different plane. The second one, which is the moderate one, which we think is more representative of what happened, we see recovery. The seven from the trend line is pretty small. It's not insignificant, though. And then obviously the recovery is there. You actually recover. You almost get back to the original. Now that is the important thing. There is the decisions of the past. I think the reason why the cushioning was there was some decisions that were taken to probably run some surpluses. If you look at the globe, most countries that were running those types of surpluses were impacted less than those that were already running deficits, and some of them are actually beginning to feel it now. They were running deficits. They also went out to try and protect themselves and save their banks and all of that, by getting more and more into debt to try and protect themselves, and they basically are now still struggling to get out of this situation. So what we're seeing basically is that the moderate scenario is probably the one that the Commission believes is where the South African economy would be. So that requires quite a significant tightening of the broader fiscal framework. What people refer to as fiscal consolidation is basically what one is talking about this. So there are some hard decisions that one must take in terms of new programs that you want to introduce and choices that must be made in terms of what type of program should you be recovering, would you be emphasizing. So we've got those things. Can we move on? Now this graph here basically talks about the impact of the crisis on poverty reduction in the South African
economy. Now, what was happening is that we were on that dotted line. We have looked at the data. It's a very long, over a very long period of time, basically, just looking at the income and expenditure survey. You're looking at the data from that survey, basically, and trying to model it and link that to what is happening on that previous graph on the economy and the sustainability of the programs that we are basically on. Now, the moderate scenario, which is what we have, is borne out by those figures, basically. What it does is that the headcount ratio under the moderate scenario is that there is an interruption in the downward trend of poverty reduction. There is an interruption. So there is a negative effect on poverty reduction as a result of the crisis. So there is a little bit of a disturbance there, but as the economy recovers, you see that it actually goes down. Now, what that must tell us, it doesn't go down as quickly, but it actually does go down until it actually reaches the business as usual level. What that tells us is that the kind of social assistance program of poverty reduction measures that we have in the environment basically worked very well. And obviously, in terms of thinking how we go forward, I'm saying that if we had been severely impacted upon and those programs were not working, we would have that big hump that would have taken us completely off in terms of even the target for your Millennium Development Goals. You would have had to postpone all of those things, completely forget about them. In fact, now this recovery basically needs to be managed properly. Now, in order to protect the vulnerable, I'm saying that the current programs that we're running, we need to consolidate them. We should not attempt to reduce those programs. We need to ensure that we keep those programs on going and ensure that we increase the efficiencies. Basically, that's what that concluding slide tries to capture, those kinds of sentiments that I've explained in relation to those graphs. Now, in terms of the recommendation, basically what we are saying is that we should continue to strive for this fiscal consolidation through limiting the growth in entitlement spending. Now, what we're saying is that we have these entitlements that we do have, your social security grants, but we are of the view that there are people that are entitled to these, so we must ensure that those that are entitled, and most of these grants are subject to means tests. We need to ensure that we are actually targeting those people that are supposed to access those types of entitlements. What we're saying is that what we have at the moment currently works in cushioning the vulnerable communities, and therefore we should continue with that expansion of child support grant. Basically, the expansion here does not mean that you must increase the bill. You're saying the coverage. I mean, there are people that are actually entitled to that from the constitutional legal perspective. They're entitled to those grants. And the same thing with your old age pension. We say we must continue to target them properly and ensure that the people that must access them do access them. We must continue with the maintaining access, the high-level access that we have to education and primary health care services. We might not be getting quality outputs in any of these areas, and we must strive then to improve the quality around those. We must also reprioritize expenditure towards repair and maintenance of existing infrastructure projects, and also initiate new infrastructure projects. You would recall that in our submission last year, what we indicated was that government has already America, even before the World Cup and the onset of the crisis, government had already decided on a massive infrastructure investment program. And that massive infrastructure investment program, in terms of our recommendation that day, we said it should also be used to create job opportunities, and therefore we must try to, where possible, go for these labor-intensive types of projects. And we think through the expanded public works program, some of those have been quite useful. They may not have been very permanent types of jobs, but some opportunities were created, and so we basically like to see that going or being consolidated, and maybe where there are weaknesses, we need to be correcting for those. In the long, medium to long term, and again, this is linked to recommendations that were made by the Commission that relate to the review of the provincial equitable share formula. What the Commission has decided as a preference is that we need to introduce block grants for around education, in particular education and health, and we might consider block grants in other areas of provincial of concurrence between provincial and national government, basically to try and protect the resources that are meant to go into those areas. Now, this is not a new recommendation. We had presented this as one of two options that we tabled for the review that's currently taking place, and I think when the Commission met this year, it then decided on a preference. The preferred option for the Commission is the block grant. We can discuss that in the context of last year's recommendations if they need it. And then what we're also saying here is that there is a need to carry out independent cost effectiveness and quality review for both in both public and private sector in education, health, and other areas of the social wage. Here, basically, what we're saying is we have all of these programs that are never really evaluated for the quality of the output that people get, and it is important that these are actually evaluated independently to check what is actually happening there. I am going to stop here with respect to the global economic crisis and what we think the fiscal space is going forward for both for the 3 years of government in terms of the division of revenue. We basically think it's going to be tight, and it's going to continue being tight, I think, probably beyond 2013, which is when we think the economy might start actually recovering. So it's a tight fiscal system. And given what is currently happening in Europe, there might be even some further disturbances to these trends, and that might actually upset even the thinking that we have presented here, because these things become more and more unpredictable as people take decisions that some people want. Now, I think what is going to follow, Chair, is that we are going to ask Vincent McKinter, with your permission, unless if you want to engage with this per section, but otherwise I was going to ask Vincent McKinter to talk in more specific terms around the social security grant, and then subsequently hand over to Teboho Makube to talk about the intergovernmental fiscal system and what we're thinking around those things, local government and all of that.
Yeah, thank you. Chair, may I just interject just a little?
Yeah.
No, looking at the structure of our presentation, the first two bullets talk more or less on macro issues, broader issues. And then the last two bullets talk more to specific issues, you know, provinces and so forth. Perhaps with the concurrence of my team, because we hadn't consulted, We could do the first two bullets, maybe just two questions of clarification, and then thereafter go to the last two bullets. Because this is an unusually long presentation compared to usual.
Yeah,
it's a long presentation. I'm already, what they call it, worried about time. But I think that the best way would be to allow you to make a full presentation, and then we will engage with that. But once we take one, we might not get to the next one. Maybe a race is testing what the current issue.
Thanks, sir. I think given the last comments, I'll try and be as efficient as possible in terms of time. This chapter, necessarily what it does, is it just gives justification for continued poverty targeting through social assistance. And I think the Deputy Chair has already made mention of the fact that in the system, South Africa, the social assistance system has played a big role in terms of the impact that the recession would have had upon us. So what I would do is run through the presentation as quick and as efficient as I can. What this slide is doing on the introduction part is to try and give reasons why we want to talk about the social assistance. And in the main is to give the historic nature of the social assistance in South Africa, and also talk about the impression of school of thoughts that are talking to the deterioration of the public finance in terms of the impression that different school of thought would have, the fence, pig on the fence, and the impact that social assistance has had on the people since 1994, and what other reservations that the Commission feels that would want to take care of going forward. And I think the reason to have this chapter necessarily is to fear, because people have been saying that we are off the issue of investment and more reducing reliance on social grants in the past. Why are we now saying something different? We are not. What the Deputy Chair has explained, this chapter necessarily does that. What these two graphs are showing, for instance, that historically you would look at the situation where around 1994 there was a jump in terms of the coverage, in terms of the people who would now receive social assistance. But then at the same time you had a system that came in terms of tax collection that improved quite a lot. So even though you had a sharp increase in the extent of coverage and the cost to the state, at the same time there was efficiency in terms of tax collection, and that in totality reduced the impact that the GDP or the economy would have had. And the same thing you could see again in terms of the overall share of the grant or social assistance on the GDP. So in a nutshell, this does that. But what this is saying is actually explaining the what I've just gone through now. Here, what the Deputy Chair has explained is to say that if you were to present, look into the history of the budget of South Africa, the budget balance, we were tabling, for instance, a deficit budget in the past, and the biggest one was around -7% in 1993. But lucky enough, we sharply moved in terms of the progress going forward. Between, I think, 2007 and 2008, we presented a surplus, and only now, after the recession, that the impact that you feel is quite low, even better than the 1993 situation. What the bottom part presents for you is to tell you that if we were to fund, this is how we're financing the government expenditure, mainly through the loans. In 1997, or between the period 1995 and necessarily this period here and that period, we were financing the system through a lot of loans. But then that reform that came through for taxes, improvement in efficiency, reduced our reliance on the loans themselves. So at this point in time, even if we have got the recession, the impact would be low because most of the financing is coming from local taxes. And that's what this graph is telling us. An in-depth look into the grants themselves would tell you that in South Africa, these grants have actually had a much spending impact in terms of the share of the total government spending. They are second highest from education, and they have moved, for instance, 1995 from 21% to 42% for the period 2000 to 2006. But there are certain of the Arab impact that we're picking up in terms of other countries. But when we look into the need to keep the social assistance in place, is to say that even though it's a good and efficient way of looking at it, other countries have looked into other forms as well. But we still feel that we could even improve the way we do it by having, for instance, in the past, the advantage with it was that it's got these tests in it, so it's not universal, and then therefore you can handpick and target poverty within the system, where if it's elderly and if it's child support grant, you know that the money is cash transferred to the people who necessarily can even link to school attendance in the child support grant. So we feel that those are a difference with our system compared to the other countries. Now, this is the evidence of that we picked up that I spoke about, that this grant necessarily boosts the spending of this recipient, as it were. But necessarily, the other point that we're raising here is that even though there's also talk of the impact that it has on other aspects, for instance, on school attendance, but in South Africa, because already our school attendance is very high, the impact will necessarily be not there or very less. So this is what the chapter, if you go in detail, will tell you. What does the future hold for us in terms of in our approach, how we think this grant social assistance helps? We feel that there's a strong case to actually make sure that you could maintain the system. And in this case, we're not promoting that expand and it becomes unreliable. You see in the chapter itself, we talk about the extent of the taxpayers, the number of people who are paying tax and the number of people who are relying on the social assistance. We're saying that you need to be wary of that to make sure that the system can cope going forward. Otherwise, you'd have to increase taxes, and then therefore you're going to have an overburden there. But then, because other forms of financing the poor are not active in South Africa, your UIF is very small in terms of contribution, your workforce is very small, then therefore the social assistance has proved to be one that's currently working, and we should try and maintain it. And I think these are the reasons we're giving there. And in terms of the recommendation, what that's what really saying is that the message from this slide is simply to say that we've got different options that we can look at. We've got an option of cash transfer. We've got an option of coming up with a basic income grant to everyone else. And what we're saying is that we are in a better position because the current system we have of social assistance is better able to target the poor and make sure that it actually gives us the impact we want without looking into other areas. So then therefore what we have now, we should continue with it and maintain it. And then therefore the commission says here that then therefore we should now try and make sure in the process of fiscal consolidation we maintain the spending as it were or protect the poor the way we've been doing it. Even though the recession has had an impact upon the economy, we should try and make sure that this initiative is maintained, and then therefore we reduce new or introduction of new system. For instance, if you are to go into a BIG or rather a basic income grant and avoid big spending and so forth. So in this case we're saying that this is chapter justifies the reason why we want to say and talk about the grant system in a period of the recession, and I think this is the message in general. Thank you, Chair.
No, it does say more on bullet 3.
Okay.
It's what we were saying.
Yeah.
Pile of conditional cash transfer.
The bullet 3, which says we should pilot conditional cash transfer, as I was saying, that in other parts of the world, there are different forms of financing the poor. And one of them is conditional cash transfer. Or welfare, for instance. What we're saying, because there's not enough money in the system currently, if we were to go into expansion of the social assistance through both the cash and non-cash, you'd want to pilot this carefully, because you don't want to go now on a full program that says, okay, let's now come up with a program where everyone, once they finish school, they now are going to get a grant and so forth, unemployment grant, for instance. So what we're saying is that if you're to take that route, you need to be cautious and take little pilots and so forth and test them, and if they work, once we recover after 2015, you could now expand the program and that's the message with the best good at three. Oh, okay. Do I need to elaborate on the website part?
No, you can.
Okay. I mean, with respect to the website part, what we're saying here is that because you could link up, you see, the challenge with social assistance is that a lot of, in the chapter, you see that as soon as people are hit by economic crisis, a lot of them lose jobs, and then the social assistance has been very effective. Now, people tend to rely on social grants from your elders and self-support. So when people lose their jobs, they would go back to households that are receiving grants and rely on the same person who is earning, say, for instance, 1,000. So your household increase and dependency on that grant becomes bigger. Now, what we're encouraging here is that, in fact, a better way to proceed in South Africa is to have workfare where people are not stuck in the cycle of poverty. They move out, so the informal sector grows, and people are now self-reliant. So the issue of workforce should be encouraged. And that's the message you're driving across, to say that have a balance, but going forward, make sure that you protect the poor in the meantime with your current strategy to target the poor through old age and child support grant. But in the meantime, the welfare is important, like your public wealth programs.
Okay.
Yeah, because what we're really saying, which is what most countries would have done, 1929, to get out of the depression, through workfare, you just find things for people to do. You may, for example, want to build robust libraries in every township, so you get people, instead of giving them money for free, they work for it, and so forth. So it's almost like we could extend the infrastructure argument and then say, instead of free money, let the people build things, let them dig dishes, let them do this and that, but we'll pay for that.
Yeah,
fill up potholes and so forth. Right. That's what the concept of what said.
Okay. I'm just looking at the recommendations and talking about what you were talking about. And I agree with you totally. Shouldn't be one of your recommendations be that we should try and go for more job creation and thereby reducing the number of people receiving social grants? I agree that we need social grants, that we should continue to pay them, and that we should keep it as simple as possible, but we should reduce them, because at the moment it's 85 billion rand a year that goes to social grants, but it's only a very few taxpayers that's got to fund that. So we should actually try and do job creation in the recommendations themselves, and be clear about them in those recommendations that, you know, we should go for job creation program.
I'd like you, Mr. Makube, to continue. I don't want you to respond now to this question. I don't want to open engagement now. But let's continue with the presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and greeting members. Then we are going to present the last five chapters, and we'll try to save time. I think this chapter 3 basically it's a review of the intergovernmental fiscal relations system in South Africa. And chapter 3.1 there is more of the review of the conditional grants. I will do the other chapter on local government revenue enhancement strategies, and then give it to Ms. Sasha Peters to do the chapter on the review of the local government equitable share and the regionalization of municipal services, the EDI case study. And then I will conclude by presenting the chapter on public transport. Now, the chapter on conditional fiscal transfers, which in South Africa we call them conditional grants, we did a study that looks at the 10-year review of conditional fiscal transfers in South Africa from 2000 to 2009-10 financial year. what is emerging there in terms of the challenges is that even though there is a broader guideline in terms of how conditional grants need to be designed, there seem not to be a guideline per se in terms of how conditional grants are introduced and terminated, adopt the intergovernmental fiscal relations system in South Africa. A classical example is what the chairperson alluded to, the grant for electrification and sanitation, provision of sanitation at schools. It was introduced and terminated without a review of whether what was supposed to be achieved has been achieved. And also the other issue that we picked up is that the allocation criteria for certain conditional grants is not clear, you know, how allocations are transferred to provinces and municipalities. And here we use municipal infrastructure grants and infrastructure grants to provinces, because in the provision of infrastructure, you'll find that there are fixed and variable costs. So how do you consider those factors when you determine the allocation? Because certain provinces might be located very far away from certain resources that are required for provision of infrastructure in terms of inputs. So do we take those into consideration and so forth? And saying that we need to review that. We can... No, okay. Yeah, the other issue then is the classification of and budget allocations by recipient governments. Remember that we have about four schedules in terms of conditional grants. The from Schedule 4 to Schedule 8 now, if I'm not mistaken. But basically, you find that there are conditional grants that are supplement equitable share, others are standalone conditional grants. And we have picked up that certain provinces use conditional grants as the major source of funding to fund certain programs, which they're supposed to, which those conditional grants are supposed to supplement the equitable share. So because of pressures at provincial level, the equitable share is not used for to supplement, or maybe as a major source, but you find that the conditional grant is a major source. But it's a challenge that is inherent in the intergovernmental fiscal relations system we have, and we have seen that coming out of the comprehensive agricultural support program and the systems improvement grant. And the other issue then, obviously, is reporting on non-financial data, or what is being delivered out of conditional grants. We find that really in certain instances non-financial data is non-existent. And now we are raising a question then as to what informs allocations in outer years if we can't verify that maybe there has been delivered on because of conditional grants. Then we come up, we have recommendations on the introduction and termination of conditional grants, that there must be a review when conditional grants are introduced and terminated. And for those that have been longer in the system, we need an independent review system to see whether you know those grants in the system are worthwhile. You know, because if they are not properly designed and targeted, you find that we can't think that there has been value for money for the introduction of those conditional grants. And we are saying that the allocation criteria needs to be made transparent. We find that in certain conditional grants, the formula used mimics the equitable share. So they just use the equitable share formula to make transfer, and we are saying that we need to identify what is the problem and why that public policy issue must be funded through a conditional grant, and we must be all aware that not all provinces and local government must benefit from a particular conditional grant. Let's identify the issue. Might find that it's not common across all provinces, and we target it and we fund, and thereafter we exist out of that issue. So this is the recommendation that we are making. And the other recommendation is around the non-financial data. We think that it's very much important. I mean, there are certain programs where we can verify delivery, you know, especially infrastructure related, where we can quantify the number of kilometers of roads, schools, bills, the issue of the electrification and provision of sanitation. Let's have the data, and if we are satisfied, then we can decide whether to continue with the program or we close it down. And that we must emphasize that the budget allocation processes must follow the grant framework, and this should be monitored, you know, as part of the Section 32 reports and of the PFMA and Section 72 of the Municipal Finance Management Act. Thanks. The next chapter is more on the revenue enhancement program and the fiscal trust. Basically, what we are saying is that there is a perception out there that most municipalities are fiscally stressed. And we have undertaken a study to assess whether that perception is true or not. And what we are seeing is that what the graph basically shows is that the all source of revenue is gradually declining. That is municipal all source of revenue is gradually declining over the years, and this is the reason why this is declining. And you can look at both the supply and the demand side of it. And the supply side of it is that there's been an increase in terms of the national transfers. And
I just want to alert honorable members that there were four copies of graphs that were distributed, and some of these graphs contained color graphs, so that these are much, much clearer than those on the
Yeah, so as I've indicated, that the one that Vincent is showing there has been declining. That is the own source of municipal own source of revenue, and the bottom one, where it's showing a spike, is that there's been
a much spike.
at between 2007 and 2009, you've seen that there's a spike relative to the years before. That is the revenue growth rate, and it's partly due to the fuel levy that has been transferred to municipalities. But also, if you look deeper, is that in a situation where there is a recession which affects municipalities, and they operate maybe through administered prices. So there is easy for certain municipalities to increase there are sources above the inflation rate, and that has been an issue that the Reserve Bank has raised over the years, that administered prices are a problem in the system. And partly, you find that if we are faced in a situation where there is a decline of revenue, it's easy to raise your administered prices above the inflation. And this is, you see, the bottom one being the inflation rate. So over the past 2 years, we have seen that going up. And the theme coming out of our submission is that we must cushion the vulnerable whilst raising the foundation for future growth and development. And we need to be careful in terms of what is happening at municipal prices. We can move over. So we are saying that certain municipalities, many of them are demonstrating chronic fiscal stress, and this is structural for certain municipalities. Structural in a sense that we know that there are certain municipalities that, because of their location and low economic base, they are finding difficult to provide certain service delivery. Others are affected by the cycle that is happening in the economy. So the fiscal stress is both structural and cyclical. And also, we are saying that the increase in the national fiscal transfer is partly or negatively affecting certain municipalities from raising their own revenue, because they now tend to rely on the fiscal. So the other part is the unwillingness by the households to pay for certain services. And that's, so there's a myriad of problems. So there's no one single problem that you can say is causing the municipalities to raise their revenue. But we are saying that out of all these challenges, municipalities are not focusing much on increasing their effort to raise revenue. You know, there are certain municipalities, we have run the numbers, we have looked at the fiscal capacity, that is the economic base, we have looked at the effort, but we come to the conclusion that there is a space and a need for municipalities to increase their effort to collect revenue. We cannot say that there is no, you know, the economic base is the reason for low revenue efforts by municipalities. And we therefore recommend that we consider options to assist municipalities to increase their revenue. And mainly the recommendations span across three major factors. That is the legislative review that must be considered. Right. We are saying that there must be some amendments in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act, and also force municipalities or municipal officers to report on the actual revenue per source and the collection rate. And the other one is around systematic and structural issues that must be done. You know, the systematic issues is around the issue of, currently we amend the local government equitable share, which SASHA will cover in broader terms, especially the revenue raising component, to make sure that municipalities that are collecting are not indirectly discouraged by what is happening
at the local government equitable share. And other issues that we are recommending there is that we must also look at what is happening at the expenditure side, because we cannot only focus on the revenue side, you know. So if there are certain interventions in terms of how do you deal with your debt management, which the FFC is the project that will take in the next research cycle, more on the debt management side of municipalities. And as I've said, that others, it's a question of having, you know, reforming your management systems, using your information systems, your financial management information systems. And we are saying there's no need for municipalities to invest on these management information systems on their own, because we are one public service. So we can, if they are working in certain municipalities, we must find a way to replicate those systems across. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Tebogo. Good morning, members of the committee. I'll be taking us through the next two chapters before handing back to Tebogo.
In future, don't allow them to give you the last chapter, because you may be under pressure, you know, as we are now. We members are itching to engage with this.
Yeah.
But it's fine, let's continue.
I'll try and be very quick. Vincent? Okay, Chair, this section deals with how to reform the local government equitable share formula and potential avenues through which its effectiveness and efficiency can be improved. Part of the reason why this research was undertaken was so that we could highlight issues that we see as being urgent, and in that way contribute to the broader review that is being undertaken by the National Treasury. This slide provides details on the component parts of the LAS, but given time constraints, I'll not dwell on them. Suffice to say that details are contained in the Division of Revenue Board. With six technical shortcomings with respect to the current formula we identified, I'll stick on a couple of them. The first relates to the lack of accurate costing framework that defines the different expenditure needs of municipalities and informs the service and administration subsidies in the LAS formula. The second relates to the inefficient calculation and application of the revenue-raising component. And as we know, an extension was granted to municipalities to implement the Property Rates Act. So this has possibly prolonged the non-availability of municipal valuation rolls. So without appropriate data, the calculation of municipal fiscal capacity and owed revenue is proving difficult. On the other, on the aspect of possible unconstitutionality of the RRC component, as we know, this component attempts to correct a municipality's allocation by considering its revenue potential and fiscal capacity. The FFC has obtained a legal opinion on the RRC component, and it actually confirms that the RRC component as it currently stands contradicts section 2272 of the Constitution, which states that additional revenue raised by municipalities or provinces may not be deducted from the share of revenue raised nationally. Then jumping to bullet point five, we've also highlighted the use of outdated data and the lack of frequent data updates, and this of course relates to the inefficiencies of using the outdated 2001 census data. So what we would recommend is that any review of the LAS should consider the following issues: a differentiated approach to funding local government, consider strengthening links to broader objectives of the local government fiscal framework, ensuring flexibility to incorporate any changes to the current free basic services policies, and also factoring in other services provided by local governments. So, for example, operating costs associated with maintaining road infrastructure. Three recommendations emanate from our research. The first is that government should use the institutional component of the LES to assist poor municipalities. The state structure of the differentiated tax mechanism relating to the revenue-raising component should be removed, and we should develop a flat gradient structure so that municipalities on the outer ends of bands are not treated unfairly. Then finally, government should develop alternative methods of revenue prediction for the revenue-raising component, this as opposed to using the indicators of actual property rates and own revenue. If I can quickly go through the chapter on regionalizing municipal services. Okay, the need to improve service delivery performance has been an ongoing government concern. And to this end, a number of...
Is your the mic on?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, as I was saying, to this, in a bid to improve service delivery performance and ensure value for taxpayers' money, a number of approaches have been undertaken. We have had legislative promulgations, we've had institutional redesign, we've also had various capacity support programs. And one of the key restructuring attempts within the local government sphere has been government's restructuring of the electricity distribution industry, where the intention is to consolidate the existing municipal electricity distributors and Eskom distribution into six wall-to-wall regional electricity distributors. This reform, attempt at reform, has been ongoing since the 1990s, and it has yet to be finalized.
So there's not one red that we're working up in everything.
There was red one.
Just send it again.
Okay. Moving on. In addition to these various attempts, we've now had the Constitution 17th Amendment Bill tabled in 2009. Now, if enacted, this bill will widen the scope for national government to regulate the executive authority of municipalities with respect to functions listed in Part B of Schedules 4 and 5. And the rationale driving this is that it will help to achieve regional efficiencies and economies of scale. The FFC has submitted its views on this bill to the Department of Justice. And basically, we are recommending caution in making these decisions. The EDI restructuring has been used as an example in the memorandum of the bill. So we've looked at the EDI restructuring and what would happen if we were to follow the approach that the bill is recommending. What we caution against, basically, is that challenges facing service delivery, particularly at the local level, are complex, dynamic, and require proper diagnosis. This slide presents a selection of research findings that emanated from our assessment of EDI, but that can also be generalized to cases of reform that the 17th Amendment, if passed, would take us. So I'll just pick on a couple of them. The first is that we need to ensure the adoption of holistic and integrated reform approaches. If you look at the case of EDI, the restructuring was thought of initially in a holistic sense. We would look at the restructuring of the distribution industry and the electricity supply industry. But since then, talk of restructuring the supply industry has fallen by the wayside, and focus is now solely on the distribution side. So So what we caution against is that, you know, if we take this approach, it can bring about incoherence and incompatibility in the sector at a later stage. Then also what we bullets 3 and 4 talk to is the need for a differentiated approach when undertaking any restructuring process. If you look at the 17th Amendment, it basically arose in response to the prolonged EDI restructuring process, but the wording of it relates, if passed, it will relate to all municipal functions. And what we're saying is that in the absence of you know, an interrogation of the challenges facing different sectors, you cannot just take a blanket approach. And the same goes with EDI. Not all distributors suffer from the challenges that restructuring hopes to overcome. So we caution against what this restructuring would do to those that are performing well. And then, of course, the social objectives of, you know, when reforming functions that form part of constitutionally mandated basic services, we need to ensure that the social objective of universal service access is not lost in the process of restructuring. Finally, coming to the recommendations we've made, the first relates to the 17th Amendment, and basically we're saying that in the absence of this assessment of specific sectoral performance challenges, we would caution against a blanket regionalization approach as the 17th Amendment proposes. We also note that current legislative provisions allow for alternative and creative service delivery arrangements that do not call for dilution of executive authority at the local level. As I alluded to earlier, not all electricity distributors suffer from the challenges that the restructuring intends overcoming. So we would suggest that EDI restructuring consider a differentiated approach that allows for recognition of these variances in performance. Government should also revisit the blueprint assumptions initially made to restructure the EDI component. As I mentioned earlier, the restructuring of the electricity industry was intended to be done as a whole, looking at all component parts. And what we need to know is, what needs to be clarified is whether it's necessary to change structure in order to bring about efficiency, economies of scale, robust regulation, and to be able to deal with management challenges in the sector. We also recommend that government conduct an up-to-date re-evaluation of the analysis of benefits of restructuring electricity distribution industry. In addition to changes that have transpired in the past 8 years and which bring into question. Okay, I'm sure we can see that you get that. Do you have copies of the book?
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry about that. Okay, so moving on. Government should also finalize all legislation and practical guidelines that relate to the EDI restructuring process. At the moment, we have the EDI restructuring bill, and also the asset transfer guide has yet to be completed. So municipalities do not know how to practically transfer assets. Government should also ensure the compatibility of operating systems that will underpin the activities of the REITs before establishing them, as it can negatively affect service delivery. And then finally, it is important that the social objective of making access to electricity universal is not lost in the process of restructuring the area. I'll now hand over to Teboho.
I think this presentation is long, and maybe we'll find a way of dealing with it. Honourable members, I know we just have over an hour. to engage. I hope you still remember where we started. You eat the elephant piece by piece. Okay, let's engage. Honorable Swap.
Okay, thank you. I've got a few questions. The one I've already asked about job creation and the reduction in social grant in the process. And I wondered whether the Fiscal Commission considered any other options and what their recommendations would be to assist municipalities to get more revenue. Because, you know, they are under stress, as you say. And are there any other ways in which, you know, they could get additional revenue? And which brings me to the rates, because if you take away the income that the profit that municipalities make out of electricity, and you take that away and that goes to the rates, and they only get that at a later stage, you have a problem. We calculated, for instance, in the case of George Municipality, that if we took the portion of profit that helps subsidizing rates and taxes, we would give that to the rates, we would have had to increase the rates and taxes by 62% immediately, just to cover the shortfall in revenue. That's just as far as rates are concerned. Then, you know, from 2011, we will have wall-to-wall municipalities. The situation is that there will be no more district management areas. So, is there still a need for C-municipalities? You know, the other question I just wanted to know, did you find in your investigations that sometimes when these conditional grants go over to municipalities, that is used to cover their overdrafts that they have with the banks, rather than being used for the purpose for which it's been granted?
Thank you. Arabi Kasaradi?
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman, I think I'd like to, my question relates to the social grant system. You know, Chairman, what worries me is that the fact is that social grants has become a necessity. We cannot do without it. But the thing is, Chairman, they say of our total population of unemployed people, I think they say it's about between 10 and 11 million people are unemployed in this country. But what's very shocking, Chairman, is that the age group between 18 and 35 makes, the number of them that are unemployed, I think that is also in about, I'd say more than 60% of the age group between 18 and 35 are unemployed. So I'd like to know, do the Fiscal Commission, I don't know whether, do they propose any way or any way that this particular age group can be accommodated and be provided with the necessary skills to participate in the economy? Because I think, Chairman, it's got dire long-term consequences if we do not address this problem. The problem. So I'd like to have their views. How can we address youth unemployment or something like that? Because that's a very, very grave danger out there, Chairman. Thank you.
Comrade Blum.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think yes, tremendous information in this document. I only at this time three questions. The one is already asked by Mr. Swart, that is the effectiveness of the third district municipalities. Do they have enough capacity because they are actually there to support the smaller and the rural the smaller municipalities, especially in the rural areas? I have some doubts about that, as I want to ask if the effectiveness is there. The second thing is, and I think that is a big problem, that is the management teams in municipalities, especially financial management teams. Now, I know that for the last 4 or 5 years, Treasury are working closely with the municipalities to assist them. But if you look at the reports, at the Auditor General reports, then there is some doubts about the effectivity of their courses they present to the to the municipalities. Where is the problem? Is the problem with the officials in the municipalities, the attendance of the courses, or is the course zoomed into the problems of the municipalities? The other thing, and I think that is what you mentioned, sir, about the question of transport coordination between national departments and the municipalities. We had a week or two ago had discussions with Treasury, with Public Works, and with SALT. And one thing was clear, there is a tremendous lack of coordination and cooperation between the spheres of government. And that brings me to the point of transport there. You can't build a hospital if there's no people. You cannot build the school, and the school is there on the hills, and the people have to work from the hills up to the top of it. The spatial frameworks of all the provinces, are they in place or not? Because you can address management if you have a spatial framework in place. You can address many of these issues if there is planning in place. And that is my problem with the spatial frameworks of the different towns and the different regions as well as the provinces. And I think if we can address this in this financial fiscal framework, then I think we can also come to certain solutions. But I find this document, Chair, that I think we can work on this, and if we can address all this, then I think we will move forward. I thank you for the moment to say if you put some questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, thank you very much for good work.
You see, don't allow Free State to disturb you when I'm talking to But I say thank you very much for your study. Honorable Mabo.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. Commissioner Khumalo, can you dissect block grant for me? Just a block grant. Slide 25 and 26 is addressing exactly the problem we have had with Treasury and with energy and water assets. Energy, Department of Energy and Department of Water Affairs around electrification of rural schools and around the issue of water and sanitation for rural schools. That's a problem that we have because Treasury told us yesterday that the department said they've done that and finished. And yet, finally, does FFC ever have anything or look at what SALGA is doing, because we've got a problem with what SALGA is doing and municipalities. The relationship of SALGA and municipalities and capitalization of municipalities, because maybe what we have at the present moment is because of the lethargy of SALGA or whatever of SALGA, but there's a problem with SALGA. Maybe around the issue of finances. And how does FSC look into that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mapala. Comrade Ramasaka.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair. I think that, let me just, from the onset, say that what I call a confession that this is a quite issues overload, information overload in terms of what has been presented. Now, I don't know engaging with it.
Information?
Overload.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's quite a sizable of information.
Mm-hmm.
You can see with the size of the number of slides that it is. Now, I don't know
whether we'll complete this engagement now or there's going to be a process. So the first thing that I wanted just to understand, there's an issue about municipality and the revenue declined in terms of the graph. Now, in the two part of the presentation, you take a scan about the environment. Now, I don't know whether reading detail in a document, what a similar scan in terms of the affordability of municipality in moving forward in terms of their LEDs, in terms of new way of approaching issues in terms of affordability, also as another way of dealing with the issue of poverty, local, addressing the local challenges of poverty. So I don't know whether in the totality of the suggestions, including the new approaches, whether that scan and suggestions is taken into the document itself. Because I also don't know the shorthand, the decline of revenue in municipality in terms of the projection over time in terms of turnaround of municipality itself, what is only linked to economic challenges and downturn, and what if you get out of the recession, based on what plan that addresses the issue of the decline in the medium to long term. What would be that strategy that if you talk about the new way in terms of addressing the grant, whether you're addressing the adjustment of how municipal raised revenue is informed of that medium to long term. So if you understand what I'm saying. The second area that I just want to talk to briefly is this issue that you raised around the maybe transport, because you ended up with that one. The integration and coordination of it. And there's been a whole lot of debate around the issue of transport, including the level of competencies. I note here what you're dealing with, the coordination and the resources. There's been even the debate around the act itself, whether the characterization of the act was indeed a correct one, given the competency and schedules 4 and 5 of the Constitution. So there's been a lot of debate around that, probably the emphasis on the act has somehow undermined the schedules and competency in terms of schedule 4 and 5 in terms of concurrency, which posed the debate as to whether is the intention to move into localized transport provision. And if the answer is yes, what will then be the mechanism of addressing the affordability, because that's linked to the resources as well. And if it's public driven or private driven, what would then be the resource base and the coordination and the integration of it? If you don't have constraining measures above that of local government in terms of the provision of it. So I don't know, in terms of the, maybe reading the document, it will answer that question. But I just think that perhaps if you could comment on that, because I know that there's been lots of tense debate about the both second provincial government and local government and national around the understanding of the National Land Transport Act and understanding the Constitution. Now, your suggestions here, in terms of the recommendation, in terms of you said there that there must be some kind of investigation of prospectors in terms of provision of public transport at local level. I don't know what that means with the context of the current or debate that has been ensuing for some time. So that's the basic two questions.
Another one now.
Thanks, Jim. I'm going to find out from the commission and actually congratulate you on a fantastic document. But the recommendations that you make, where have we tested them to say, if we put those into place, what impact will they have on the current policy processes and systems of government? And that impact, what will it achieve socially? And the cost of changing that. So I'm trying to work out where to from here, kind of thing. That's fantastic, but what impact are these going to have generally? Thank you.
Now they will answer for themselves, but but I understand to be the recommendation to government saying, look, these are the recommendations that we're suggesting moving forward.
I saw you, what was your hand?
Or it was nothing, anything. Now, I think that the question has been raised, and I think also the question that the question that Bab Khumalo, who Mama Ngozo raises around this block grant, you know? I think that would really need more clarity and the implications of that block grant. You know, you indicated in your input extensively about all these other grants coming in and out. But now with this block grant, as to what is it that is going to mean. But with slide on page 10, on the recommendations, that for instance, maybe government could pilot a conditional cash transfer and welfare program. Now, vis-a-vis the last, what we call a point on that slide, which says avoid universal income grant. If you are suggesting that there should be a pilot, what we call a conditional cash transfer, I'm not sure how they differ from the universal, what you call, this basic income grant. And I think that the last bullet is saying it's something that needs to be avoided. I agree with, but those two bullets, isn't there a contradiction? Now you will tell me, see what you're saying, but you really clarified for me.
Yeah, so I think that the rest of the questions the members have raised, but with the, you're saying you find with the grants, the way the current grants are, the way the government is delivering on the targeted grants. We had, the honorable members, if you remember, we had a report from the HSRC. Who are saying, so we're just merely scratching the surface of poverty. It doesn't reach a lot of what you call a poor people for many reasons. I'm not sure if you were not there. One, access to IDs, lack of access to IDs for other people, children, and all kinds of people who don't know what's happening in the country. They were talking about a sizable number. Now, what are we saying to this thing? So, you seem to be saying it's reaching a number of people, many people. HSRC says
maybe 50%, I'm just putting my own figures, they didn't say that exactly, but they were saying there's a sizable number which don't receive anything. And that results to stunted children and all kinds of particular things that are happening, you know. Well, the question has been raised about the 17th Amendment. No, fine. Yes.
Sorry, Chair. I just want to associate this my thinking with, if ever it is relevant to FFC. In the allocation of national government spending on public transport, I'm trying to coin it with the subsidized buses, especially in the rural areas where it carries school kids. I'm just checking with the FFC whether they have got this system to check with the municipality on the local ground. How best do they assist you with these subsidies for school kids in those roads, especially for these subsidized buses, if ever there is a link? Maybe this is particularly and mainly to be dealt with education and transport, but I'm just checking if ever there is a link on those.
Chair, I'm quickly following up on your question on grants. Maybe this is not the role of NFC, but having had a briefing from the Public Service Commission, some of these grants have been misappropriated or there was corruption from among the employees within the social development, within social development and other departments. Are you in a position to look into those findings from Public Service Commission or maybe the department? I don't know where your role would be. Thanks.
Just the last one from my side. I'm not sure if Honorable Snell was raising this question of taking into account the kind of economic picture that you were projecting for us, that or I'm not sure whether it was one of us there between the two, that these grants, aren't they receiving a climax, you know? I mean, can government continue to afford this, what we call just dishing out the grants? There was a project some years ago that was, or a program that was established, the National Development Agency. I'm not sure if you have had any research into it, because it was meant to take other people away from your social grant so that other people can be active. I don't know if you have done any study on it, if it is delivering anything. Thank you.
Is it our turn now, sir?
Sorry?
Is it our turn now?
We are in your hands. But
before we go, I'm in a presser here next to you. The advice that I'm getting is correct. But some years back, we did have a discussion with you around engendering your, what you call it. And at that time, we saw that you started, and all of a sudden, we slid down, you know. We lucky today, there's one woman. I'm saying we're lucky, but I think, in terms of government policy, it is serious, but
women, the youth, is disabled people, must really, all government, what you call it, institutions must ensure that there is empowerment. But with FFC, we really think that you really need to check up your, what you call it, this in general, what you call it.
I don't have the former chair was a lady.
And then we're having someone here. Let them apply and let's do the work.
Now I'm not talking to Azama. We are not a gender committee.
Well, the chairperson has spoken.
But, Chair, if you allow us, in the last 6 months, we've read four.
We had four?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're still there. They're working on other projects. So maybe one day they'll come. I'm sorry, Chairman, we have four.
I don't want to call my leader out of order, you know? I don't want to do that. Let's see if that is possible. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Before I ask my colleagues to answer, I would just like to put the context. The context of our presentation is that we are presenting here against economic recession. And we are saying there are issues of cushioning people who are losing jobs, are suffering, are getting grants, and so on, just so that, you know, they can survive the recession. But we are saying at the same time, government should continue with the growth project that it's got. And then if we put back that diagram that Bongani was talking to, you see? Yeah, that graph, that is, yeah, right. If we look at that graph from 100, we are saying that the economy was on that path moving up to our right this way. But then the recession caused it to dip. And then it dipped there and underneath that area, underneath there. Yeah, right. And then it started working through government policies and the improvement of the international environment. It started working its way back. But then in getting back its way, going back on its way, it's running parallel to the trajectory that should have happened if there was no recession. So it's just running parallel there. So we are saying that the long-term policies that the government should institute should be the ones that push back that dip back to where we had seen it to go, straight up this way. So that's really what we are saying there. Now, some of our recommendations then go towards cushioning people and also ensuring then that there is growth. Now, on issues that I think Honorable Swartz asked, there was a question on job creation and social grants. So there we were emphasizing the point that there should be workfare, meaning that people should actually be paid for work done, because there is a lot to do, especially in the area of infrastructure. You know, people can get paid to do that work. So that's a question that we are highlighting there. And then that would also then include the issue of youth unemployment, because there was a question of what must happen to the youth. The youth must go out and work. You know, yeah, right. And but work should be found, and there should be programs that get them to work. I think that is one issue we are highlighting. And then, you know, what we are really then saying is that our recommendations are not really asking for more money. They are asking for efficiencies. We are saying there are a lot of inefficiencies in the system, and this comes out in the, you know, we are saying, for example, in terms of conditional grants, the money that is being given anyway to the aged, to the children, and so forth, is not giving out in an efficient way. There's a lot of waste. So we are saying that waste comes because these grants are never argued properly, they are never planned for properly before they are put into the system. And then a lot of times when they are withdrawn, there are no lessons learned. They are just withdrawn just like that, and then the result is that there's just wastage. So we are saying the system needs to be improved in that manner. And then we are saying in terms of local government revenue enhancement program, there are many ways that the local government can actually enhance their revenue. We don't have to look for new revenue sources for them. We are just saying what you are doing, do it well and do it properly. That is basically, I think, what we are saying. And then I think on the equitable share, you will just include it with a block grant there, and on regionalization again, I think Sasha, or you can do it. And then on transport, you can do those questions. But I think as a highlight first, Bongani can even just repeat a bit of what I talked about. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think there's quite a number of questions that have been raised, some of which maybe it's a good thing that we've got Wendy here from the Treasury. She might say something about them, there because they're really beyond our competence. I think the one that I'll single out is the one that says, is there a need for Category C municipalities at this point in time? I might have my own views, but I think it's not beyond our competence to respond to that one. But let me start off by talking about the block grant issue and contextualize that recommendation. Firstly, a block grant is simply a grant that is transferred to a sub-national government or to another sphere of government from another sphere with very little conditions attached to it. It's normally transferred to say you can spend this grant in this area. So, for example, if I say we need a block grant for education, I'm saying at this point in time, if we look at the equitable share formula, how it's structured, it's got blocks in it. At a technical level, you say you've got this waiting for education, this waiting for health, and this waiting for social development. But you are not saying in any way that a province must spend that percentage or that weight on education and must spend that weight on health and must spend that. You're not saying that. You're basically saying, here is your money, but in this money what I've done is like I've made sure that you get this much for education. So I'm trying to send a signal to where you must emphasize your allocation on how your budget, what must inform your budget, send indicative weight. Now, it's still a block grant as it is, because we might say that the equitable share is a non-conditional transfer. We are not being truthful. The true sense of the word, the provincial equitable share, is meant to ensure that provinces are able to deliver on their constitutional mandate. So that's in the area of provision of basic services and any other mandates assigned to them. Now, What this recommendation is saying is that it's saying this is the money that goes to education. So the vertical division would basically determine what, if we prioritize education, these are the priorities for education, and this is how we calculate. During the vertical division process, you already know how much you will give for education and how much you will give for. So what you're then saying, by saying this is a block grant, you are actually tightening that constraint that says provide basic services. So instead of saying you're constitutionally mandated basic services, you must meet through your Kita Bushe. You are now saying, these are your mandates. This is what you will need for education. This is what you will need for health. And this is what you will need for... So spend it only on education. Spend it only on health. So whatever you do within education is really the decision of the province. But the allocation has actually been made in such a way that the education sector knows that if we get this much money, because up there they've been identified these types of priorities, this money must actually be seen to be going into those priorities. That's all that the block grant is saying. So the term block might sound like we are talking about a new thing. We are talking about exactly the same thing that we have, except that we are tightening the constraint around it. So it's a tighter condition rather than what we have now, where you say all your mandates. So you can decide to take money that you ideally wanted to see being spent on education, you take it and put it on transport, or you take it and put it on airports or something like that. That's what we're trying to say. It's the tension, obviously, that is there between what you're looking at a national level in terms of priorities and what might actually happen at a provincial level in terms of priorities. So you're trying to tighten that area through that system. I hope this answers it. If it doesn't, you could look at our submission that we made last year, where we presented two options. The one of those options basically spoke directly to the issue of a block grant and how we envision the calculation taking place. There are certain issues that must be defined up front, so we need to have norms and standards. And that is why the issue of introducing a block grant is presented here as something that we must look at in the medium to long term, because you need the department to basically define clearly what the minimum norms and standards are going to be, so you're actually able to get to calculate it. If you want to do it as soon as possible, you can start by looking at the input side. What are they currently spending? And then you define norms on the basis of what they are currently spending. And that's not a very good idea, because there's a lot of inefficiencies around. They don't know why they are spending what they are spending. So it's that kind of a discussion that is around that. Now, with respect to the chair's question around the HSRC report on the child support grant and where it goes, and I think what one of the issues that we're raising is the efficiency with which some of these programs are actually run. That's why we're talking about an independent review of all of these things. Maybe the HSRC is the institution that is appropriately positioned to probably carry out those kinds of reviews to check whether the money that we're actually putting there is actually doing what it's supposed to do. From where we sit, we work with numbers that are published, and we then, what we did was then to model those numbers to check what they are actually doing in terms of published statistics. If you look at your income and expenditure survey, it will tell you what is actually happening to households and all of that. So you're basically doing modeling exercise and testing ideas or perceptions against what statistics basically tell you. And so from our conclusion is that we are seeing a trend. What we're doing is to establish trends rather than look at what is actually happening at any one point in time, which is what probably a survey normally does. Ours is a long-term assessment of trends rather than across a time frame. Now, the issue around the workfare and conditional cash transfers that you raised, I think if, again, it's linked to our submission that we made last year. Remember, when we made our submission, we said the government must take advantage of the massive infrastructure program or investment program that it has identified and try and utilize that to pilot projects for workfare. And we think that your expanded public works program and the incentive grant part of it, the idea
is a very good idea, but whether we are actually applying it, that is why we're saying don't just rush into it, but you would rather pilot it and see whether it's actually, it is actually working. At this point in time, I think, I'm sure that it was your committee that that hosted a big discussion around the current one and the results over from the past year. Obviously, there's quite a number of problems there, and I would like to link that to the SALGA question that that you raised. We do work with SALGA on issues of mutual interest. I mean, it's primarily through the work that they do for the budget forum and the work that we do for the budget forum. That's where we work with. What they actually do with municipalities, we don't actually know. We are aware that this is what they are supposed to do, but whether they do it or not, we don't actually get into those kinds of, so it would be very difficult to answer the question in a more useful way than that. Okay. The issue around the test of the recommendations, I think really what you're saying is if these recommendations in the way in which they are tabled, what would be the cost of implementing them, or what would be the benefit of implementing them? I think what we are trying to do with the recommendations is we are trying to look at the environment and then try to see how we can actually progress, how we can move from where we are, where we identify a gap. We then want to say, in order to move forward from where we are, this is what we need to do. Now, who must actually do that? I think National Treasury primarily get these recommendations and they look at them and they say whether or not what we are saying makes sense. But from where we see it, especially now that the terrain, some of the terrain that we've entered basically has to deal with the broader macroeconomic issues. The broader macroeconomic issues will basically fit into your committee, for example, in looking at what the National Treasury provides you, the kind of information and testing the credibility of that information. It's really the recommendations are made to you to decide. If you want to follow a recommendation and say to us, if we were to implement this particular recommendation, what would be the fiscal or financial implications of it? We should be able to follow up on that ourselves, but it's really made for you to engage with the National Treasury, and they can deal with it in that manner. Linking the local government, what is happening in local government in terms of revenue and the new revenue sources, I think what Dr. Tuta is saying is part of the story. The second part of the story is that there is the municipal fiscal powers and functions Act that was passed, I think it's now over a year now, that municipalities are expected to utilize it. That is if they want to identify new revenue sources. So that there's enabling legislation that basically allows the municipality to investigate that. And I think at the moment, municipalities, I think especially the metros, have put together something to do with the local business tax that they are dealing with, which in terms of that process. But it's still to come back to the FFC. I know that it was presented at the budget forum last year. That's an attempt by municipalities to do that. Now, from our perspective, I think linking the trend in municipal revenue and the economic downturn, whether municipal revenues are actually impacted upon. If you look at the document itself, the main submission on page 17, there's a table there that looks at income and savings of government. And it, at the bottom there, it's table one. It shows what happens under the two scenarios, the moderate and the severe scenarios to provincial government income. And it also shows what happened to local government income. You can see that local government income basically is impacted on far much heavier than
than provincial income. And it's simple, the explanation is very simple, because provinces depend quite heavily on transfers. So they have very little on revenue sources. Now, municipalities, on the other hand, depend quite heavily on payments for services. Now, when people are losing jobs, obviously they will default. And so the more and more people lose jobs, the more and more people default. And you also your poorer people, because you, somehow you will need to do something on your revenue side with your tariffs and all of that. You have very little room to maneuver, because if you raise your tariffs, then even those that you're paying might actually fall out of the net, and that is the problem that municipalities have to confront. Very inflexible on the spending side, because people expect services. It's also very limited flexibility on the revenue side, because they can't do very much about their tariffs. So you end up squeezing those small numbers that you have. And I think that's what I was trying to demonstrate with that graph there. But yeah, I think let me then stop here and allow Teboho to respond to the public transport issue, and then Sasha to respond to the race issue. And I suppose I requested Wendy to please say something about the category C stuff.
Well, the public transport issue, let me say that there's ongoing work around public transport. And also to caution members that it's an illusion in a way to think that the fiscals will solve public transport challenges in the country. No, the Act, the Land Act of 2009, devolved most of the public transport functions to municipalities. And obviously there must be budget reforms for municipalities to be able to provide the function, right? Then there are issues that have been raised by honorable member around the capacity there, because if you talk about the public transport, the Act says that the municipality must plan for transport networks, and the transport networks involve road and the rail network. Now, does the municipality have the capacity to manage the rail network? There's never been their function to do that. So we are going to face those challenges in terms of the train scheduling, for instance, the rail maintenance function. Because even with Trasa, most of the rail networks are owned by Transnet, not by Trasa, by Trasa. So there must be reforms in terms of your assets, in terms of your maintenance functions, but also the issue, I think, for the Commission is the funding and the design for the subsidy. Currently, there are debates whether who do you compensate in the design for subsidies. Is it your taxi recap, you give it to the owners, or do you give it to the passengers? You know, if you give it to the owners, how does that translate to the affordability for the passengers? You know, if you give it to the passengers, how does that relate to your overall social security system in terms of poverty alleviation? So those are the debates that must be resolved. And also, what is the public policy objective of subsidies? Is it poverty alleviation? Is it environmental concern? Is it shifting people from using private motor vehicle into public transport? So I think those are some of the work that the Commission will continue to engage in. Yeah, while there was an issue around the linkage between school transport and the role of municipalities, I think that is an example of the inefficiencies that we have in the system, because you find that in urban areas, public transport is not a challenge per se in terms of accessibility. You know, people can access taxis, trains, and so forth. But in rural areas, it becomes a problem, where there is no provision, you know, of public transport, and there is a burden then on maybe the province to provide the school transport through subsidies and so forth. But I've come across a study that shows that municipalities and provinces engage in each other, either in the allocation of the school transport subsidy or other bus transport subsidies. But as I'm saying, that these are the areas that require that we review and provide an advice on.
Now, just before Sasha comes in, I'm not sure. Maybe one needs to remind oneself about the National Land Transport Transition Act. If it included within their plans that municipalities should play a role as far as the railways are concerned. This was not my understanding. Maybe I have not looked at it, but sorry. But well, I'm not sure if you're talking about Land Transport Act of 2009, but the one of 2000. I don't think that the municipalities had really a role to play there. I mean, that was, I was also involved in that one. I can't remember what you said, but maybe I'll have to go back.
No, the current act, Jefferson, calls for service level agreements between rail suppliers and municipalities, but the overall functions in terms of planning of the transport network lies with the municipalities.
Okay. Chair, I think the question related to the effect of the rates on the income of municipalities. There will basically be two forms of compensation for municipalities. The one is dividends, because municipalities will be shareholders in the rate that they are part of. And the other is the local government levy or surcharge, which is in recognition of the fact that municipalities earn significant surplus from distributing electricity. And they use the surplus often to cross-subsidize the delivery of other services. The adequacy of these, well, if we just look at dividends, we are told by EDI that they'll be zero to minimal initially, and will only start to increase from years 4 and 5. In addition, these rates will be new entities made up of municipalities and, where applicable, ESCOM. And there's really no sure way of predicting their performance and therefore, for example, dividends.
But the Act also provides that for some transitional arrangements. Yes, in the interim.
Okay, we have just one more question on financial management capacity.
Are there a gentleman sitting at the back?
Yes,
I made a mistake not to introduce everyone, because the people at the table, we know about the people behind you.
Yeah, my name is Edira Kale, also with the SSC. The question.
No, but you're not talking so that you should hear. You're just talking to yourself.
Okay. Edira Kale. I'm going to answer the question around the.
Find a place, man.
The question on financial capacity building in municipality. What we did last year was a study around the capacity building within municipalities, and one of the focus was mainly on financial capacity. And what we found was that there's a lot of shortage of financial skills in municipalities. But then again, there's also a lot of there's quite a lot of turnover rate with of people with financial skills, and you've got programs such as financial management grant from the treasury as well as in Zamanje that tries to capacitate municipalities with financial skills. But the major issue we found was that most these programs, like many other government programs, they are not coordinated. You find that financial management grant people will go and do their own things. The CNZ Manje from DBSA will go and do their own things. And as a result, what we find is that there is lack of coordination and the programs are reactive. They are not necessarily responding to the problem because they are temporary and as a result, they don't really. We don't really get the outcomes. And what is really concerning is that these financial, these capacity programs are very expensive. So we don't really get the outcomes that is associated with the input with this capacity building. Just to add on the question that was raised around whether there are ways that we can assist municipalities to raise more revenue. The main message we are trying to deliver here is that municipalities themselves, they've got to help themselves raise revenue. We're trying to avoid a situation where every now and then there's a problem within municipalities, national government rush in and give more money. So what we are saying is that municipalities themselves have got to show at least some effort to raise revenue and explore all the available resources before we can say that a municipality is got revenue shortages. And because currently we don't even really know for sure whether municipalities are, it's just a perception. So what we are saying is that municipalities, according to our experiences, are under collecting some of the revenue which they're supposed to be collecting. And until such time they've optimized revenue collection, we cannot speak about more revenue possible. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. But I think that maybe one day you have to give us a presentation about the point that you are raising. You're welcome. because I'm not sure if I hear what you're saying in terms of municipalities raising revenue, but I'm not sure if you're talking about the 283. But I think that between you and I, we do know that there are municipalities like Mshaweng in the Northern Cape. There's no revenue, what you call a base altogether, where you could begin to say they must collect these, unless you're saying they must tax the huts that are there and what. And then you must be prepared also for the response that you'll get for the community if you start taxing those huts and doves and what. So maybe you have to give us a full input one day on that. Maybe, yes, I may agree with you, say some of them. You were saying now, Wendy, must... Okay.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and if I could just be given 2 minutes to actually also explain why National Treasury is here today. It's that it's not the National Treasury's response to the FFC recommendation, it's actually government that responds to the recommendation.
Who raised that question?
But it's the FFC that indicated National Treasury will respond. But I think...
I'm not fit to say they're asking for your assistance somewhere.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'll answer that one as well. But just to explain how we actually then relate back to the process, because it's important for these discussions as well.
Okay.
What we then do after we've received it with the coordinator, so for example, with respect to the taxes that deal with local government, those issues we'll consult with the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. To transport issues, we'll revert back to the Department of Transport. And on the issues of EDI restructuring, the Department of Energy will be consulted. So those inputs that received will be important. The processes in the past were very helpful as well, where the national departments responsible for the sectors were then called to actually respond to the various chapters, which then also formed the basis of the national government response as well. So that is the way that in the end of the day we then come to the final input from national government that's been submitted as part of the Division of Revenue process. With regard to the specific question that's been asked with respect to the Category C municipality, I'm going to give a similar response to what the FFC gave. It's not in the competency of National Treasury either. That responsibility actually vests with the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. If you look at the Municipal Structures Act, it allows the legislation. That responsibility actually vests with the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs to determine how municipalities are configured, and it also lies with the Municipal Demarcation Board. So they're more appropriate to actually answer the question whether Category C municipality should be in existence or not. Just to clarify where National Treasury comes into this process, after the profit structures for municipalities are determined, i.e. to how many Category A municipalities or metros we should have, how many Category B municipalities we should have with what type of functions, what type of Category C municipalities we should have, it's then our responsibility to align the fiscal system to actually support those municipalities to provide service delivery. An important issue that we should raise here as well, it also links back to the Constitution.
What makes
the current system extremely complicated is that what was authorized and what is happening on the ground is not exactly the same issue. For example, you would get district municipalities that's authorized for water and sanitation, but in reality, the local municipality is still responsible for providing a lot of the water and sanitation functions. So in terms of the Constitution, what we have to do from the fiscal side is to actually give the funds to the municipality that's authorized for the service. So the district municipality will, in those instances, be receiving all the equitable share funding, all the infrastructure funding, and all other conditional grants that's related to that service. And the responsibility is then on the district municipality to sign service delivery agreements with the local municipalities that are then providing, particularly, for example, free basic services to the poor, where those agreements are not necessarily signed, which makes the system extremely complicated. And that's where the misalignment is currently taking place. But how the district municipality should be configured in future, that question rests with Octa.
Well, we don't know when is the future, because I think our worry is what's happening currently. I know some municipalities where there are tensions between your Category B and C around these issues, because C sometimes it's C that does not even have the capacity to deliver. Especially areas that we visited in the Eastern Cape, there was a lot of that was happening. But I think that if that is the case, it would be very useful, you know, to get information as to exactly where is that happening. Because I think that we would be depriving municipalities that are supposed to be getting that capacity to be able to deliver the service, if because the Constitution says it's Category C that must receive the allocation, and sometimes it doesn't have the capacity to deliver. I think maybe if we could get in some cases a breakdown of where is this happening exactly, I'm sure you would be having the information. It would be useful. Honourable members, the question was raised earlier as to
to whether we think that we'll finish with this discussion of the past. Also, maybe if we can go through the submissions of FSC to familiarize ourselves, I think that it will be useful. We're not going to take Mr. Masube the second round. I'm sure you had very little from this first round of questions. But at this stage, I think that we would like to maybe adjourn the meeting, and then we will let the FFC know in terms of the way forward. I do understand that FSC has got to make presentations to other stakeholders. I'm not sure if you... Yeah, I do remember that we had a meeting with the NSOP wing of the appropriation. Yeah. I think then, just to clarify between ourselves, we don't want to do this repetition. For me, I don't think that it's useful, you know, where you present to appropriation of the NSOP and us, because I think it's the same presentation that you're making. But we will revert back to you in terms of the way forward. But the recommendations as they stand, I think that they are very useful, and they are more useful for this committee, because at the end of the day, even we will be interested in hearing what National Treasury's response will be after at the right time.